much of this is trust. And, you know, something happens when we grow up that we lose all of our trust. And so that's why I always encourage people who are working on inversions to work against the wall, and then slowly back themselves away from the wall, because you've got to have something when you start doing inversions, to build up the trust that you lost, that we all have when we're kids, and then somehow just disappears.
My name is Jeff Little. This is The Attentionist.
Thinking about these things and educating the populace about them.
I'm sorry, I really don't know what you're driving at. I just don't.
Holler and holler and holler.
Perhaps the wall is bathed in a yellow light, or perhaps there's been some interference in Bob's brain, but that's how he sees the white wall.
Welcome, dear friends, to another edition of the Attentionist podcast. My name is Jeff Little. I so enjoyed the chance to sit with the guest that we have today. Her name is Jennifer Chenal. I call her Jen. She goes by Jen. But she and I met because of yoga. And I go to a yoga studio, Hot Yoga Plus, on Elliston Place, which is off of West End here in Nashville, in the Vanderbilt area. And Jen and I have had loose conversations here and there, and I will let the audio speak for itself, but she was just someone that I was like, I would love to ask her a few questions about how her life has unfolded, because it's a beautiful life, and I was inspired by it, and she kindly agreed to come, and we sat in my kitchen, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jen Chenal to the podcast. There's information on Jen at the attentionist.com website, so you can go there and learn more about Jen specifically, but the interview will do a good job of introducing you to her. So without further ado, my conversation with Jen Chenal.
I really like getting the class done early in the day. Honestly, it started because my husband's a surgery resident, and he got up early, and it's just easier to get up together. So that's how I really started the early classes.
What is your more favorite style of yoga class to lead?
Oh, gosh. That's a tough question, and it probably depends on the day. I love vinyasa classes because I love coming up with a new sequence every time. Although sometimes the night before, when I'm furiously trying to plan a class, I don't love it so much, but actually doing it, I love it. But I started with Bikram, the Hot 26 style. I think that's will always be my first love. I can't imagine not ever practicing the Hot 26 style. I think it's a great series, and I love teaching everything about that series. I've picked up so much knowledge about that series over the years. I love continuing to teach it.
Just for our listeners, when you say vinyasa, can you explain that word a bit?
Oh, gosh.
Just what it means. I don't mean you have to go into, like, the Sanskrit or what have you.
Right.
What does that mean to you as a teacher, in terms of, like, what to expect from that kind of class?
Well, so most vinyasa classes are loosely based off of poses in the Ashtanga series. So the Ashtanga series, I believe there's 6 series of Ashtanga, and they include poses of like upward facing dog and downward facing dog and sun salutations, some of the common floor poses to yoga classes like Baddha Konasana, bound angle, boat, Navasana, things that you'll see in most yoga classes, honestly. And so most vinyasa classes are essentially the Ashtanga poses in a different sequence. Vinyasa is just really a different sequencing of the traditional Ashtanga series.
You mentioned a minute ago how you're able to script in so many words, the kinds of poses we'll be doing that I've done in your classes. What, you don't have to give away any secrets, but what is a kind, and put this in a nutshell, feel free to be as brief as you like, but what is the kind of experience you're thinking of when you're scripting a class?
So I think at this point, in my yoga teaching career, I tend to teach two different types of classes. I either teach a class that tends to focus on a body part. So I think today we're going to do all different types of push-ups,
yes.
which you have been part of those classes. Yeah. But the other kind of class that I really like to teach, and it's something that I picked up from an Anusara teacher who has been a mentor to me, is thinking about a peak pose that I want to build towards. Mm-hmm. And then every posture leading up to it, every sequence leading up to it, is thinking about building up to that peak pose, which we get to the end.
Yeah. Your classes are always smooth in the sense that they go from sort of a peaceful stretching into an increasingly more challenging circuitry of poses. And then when you're talking about the peak pose, my, you know, a lot of times for me, I'm like, well, this has got to be the most difficult one, because I can't imagine a more difficult one after this one. and your classes are, for me, they're one of the real benefits of taking from you. For me, it's just really, it's encouraging. And your attitude about it is, yes, you can. And and it, you are, one of the things for me that you do that is helpful, and now I'm outing myself, it's going to be embarrassing next time we're in class together, but but when you do see one of your students that's doing something pretty good, you're like, nice, Jeff, or nice, Steve, or whomever. That's always really helpful to me, because I feel like the class is challenging.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that the class is challenging, and I think it's very easy to slip into that space of, I can never do this, so why would I even try? And I never want my students to feel that in my class.
Yeah.
Because I think fundamentally advancing in your yoga practice just takes time.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people this all the time. People say, oh, you have a beautiful yoga practice. And I have a lot of people ask me, oh, you must, did you dance or do you dance? And that's why you're so good at yoga. And yes, I did dance. And yes, when I started yoga, I was very flexible. But what most people don't know is that I was not strong at all. Like, I could not do a push-up to save my life.
Really?
Yes. So
she is human.
I am human. And so I hate when people ask me that question, because there's this underlying assumption of, well, the only reason she can do yoga this well is because she had some advantage going in that I didn't have. And I want to tell these people, no, it's just time and patience and falling out and getting back in 100 times. And, you know, maybe on the 101st time, you stick it for a second. And then on the 102nd time, it doesn't work anymore. But, like, by the 500th time, you're getting it pretty consistently. I mean, that's really what building an advanced yoga practice is about, I think.
That sounds really good to me. So I began with Hot Yoga Plus having never done any yoga before. I began in November of 2011. I had a Groupon. And a couple of friends had been like, dude, seriously, you should try it out. And one guy friend in particular, and he was not a normal type of... He was more of a dude. And the thing, we were talking about it because I had some back pain for the first time. And my dude buddy was like, are you doing anything to develop your core? Which is a question guys don't necessarily ask each other a whole lot. We'd rather talk maybe about either running or maybe like something happening in the weight department with bench press or deadlift or something. But my buddy was interested in how my core was doing. And I said, no. He's like, if you strengthen your core, you'll be surprised at how your back will be stronger. It was kind of like physiology 101 kinds of things. I conveniently never wanted to pay attention to that stuff. I went, and the thing for me that was helpful right away was not how I certainly wasn't really very good right away, but the attitude and the everyone talks about the energy, good energy. The instructors, including you, the belief that you can do this and this is a safe environment, and it's always repeated, especially in the morning classes. The hardest part of getting here is over. You got to your mat.
That's right.
And no, that's not true, but it always feels good to hear that. I get the sentiment behind it. So, for me, here we are approximately 4 years later. I've been such a happy customer with Hot Yoga Plus. I've made just improvements in my physical health. I've made friends through the club, and I've just learned a lot about a lot of things. I mean, it's just been a really positive thing in my life. I'm like one of the members where I just pay a flat thing every month, and so I just go to any class I'd like. Right. And I've been to many workshops, which are kind of bonus opportunities. One day I may go to, you know, one of these yoga retreats. Maybe like the final frontier for me. But I don't think you've given us the factoid yet, given me the fact. You first started yoga about when in your life?
So I started yoga my senior year of college, which would have been 2002.
Okay.
So I have just instantly aged myself.
We'll edit that out.
No, that's okay. So I had danced growing up. I quit dance in college. And my senior year of college, I turned in my senior thesis and suddenly had more time. And in college, I had gone to the gym just to keep active, but never really loved going to the gym. Never could really stick with one thing because I liked interesting movement, not the repetitive movement that happens at the gym. And so I suddenly had this time. I walked down to a hot yoga studio, a Baron Baptiste studio, which is a hot vinyasa studio, that was a half mile away from my dorm, and took my first hot yoga class with a friend. My friend hated it with a passion and never went back. Oh. I found it really challenging, as everyone finds it really challenging, the first class I did, but I felt great afterwards, mm-hmm. and all I wanted to do was go back. And so I went fairly regularly at the end of my senior year of college, and then I started grad school at Vanderbilt in the fall, and I wanted to continue doing yoga. I really liked hot yoga. And so, I guess as fate would have it, the week that I moved to Vanderbilt, the Vanderbilt student gym was closed. And I thought, well, what a great time for me to find a hot yoga studio. And I found one across the street from Vanderbilt's campus. Okay. And the rest is history. I've been practicing there ever since.
In total, we're talking about a little over...
Like 9 years.
Yeah, 9 years.
Yeah.
9 years. And talk to me, I mean... The instructor portion, that began about when?
So I did teacher training in 2008. I started practicing more and more during my first year of graduate school. I found it such a good release and such a different thing than what I was doing in grad school. I found such a good life balance with yoga that I found myself suddenly practicing every day. And then, so I guess in the spring of 2008, the former owner of Hot Yoga Plus approached me about doing their next teacher training. Foolishly, maybe, I was getting married in 4 months, and I thought, yeah, of course I'll sign up for teacher training 4 months before I get married. It's not like I'm going to be busy or anything. So I did, and I mean, I worked really hard that summer, and it was a crazy, crazy, crazy summer, and for anyone who's ever done a teacher training will know that you are active and practicing and doing things all the time. And so I kept also having to have my wedding dress altered down besides everything else, which I guess is good, but annoying. It was great. And I've been teaching ever since. I've been teaching, I guess, full time since July of 2008. Well, I guess not full time, part time, yeah. Since 2008.
At the level of someone that is, I mean, to my opinion, our most at Hot Yoga Plus, our most committed teachers are teaching probably 2 or 3 times a week, and you seem like you're doing that pretty much. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, I teach, I guess, starting this week, 4 classes a week at Hot Yoga Plus. Wow. And they're all in the early morning and they're all before work. I teach quite a bit. When I was in graduate school, I taught, gosh, like 6 or 7 classes a week, which is a little crazy. But 3 or 4 is a much better number for me.
I wanted to ask you about, this is so derogatory, I'm going to get in trouble. I'm going to call it the more woo-woo side of yoga.
Okay.
I don't want to call it the more spiritual side, that doesn't seem like the right word, but maybe the more ancient side of it.
Okay.
And talk to me about your opinion on this. With Hot Yoga Plus, where we go, it seems to focus more on sort of an athletic essence. There are other yoga studios around Nashville, and I'm sure, and certainly other parts of the world, that are focused more on, I'll use the word ritualistic, and I mean nothing but respect. I'm just not sure the right handles to use when I'm talking about, and you probably know those handles, those words to use. Could you just, what do you think about that? Is that an assessment that's somehow correct, or I don't know?
So I think this is a source of a lot of controversy in the yoga community. So here's what I do know. So this sort of athleticism in yoga really came about in India in the late 19th, early 20th century. And the idea behind it was if you exhaust your body, then you can still or focus your mind a little bit more. Our minds are constantly running. If we just sort of give everything we've got in a very physical practice, and we're so exhausted that we can't do anything except be still anymore, then we can reach a greater connection with the spiritual world. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of the theory that things like Hot 26 Bikram Yoga run off of, and to the extent that Hot Vinyasa practices are an offshoot of that, that's very much the mentality as well. Personally, I think that's a mentality that very much appeals to me. Mm-hmm. I'm very much a type A person who is multitasking all the time, do this, do that. Trying to figure out how many things I can do at once and how many things I can get done in a day. Mm-hmm. And so to have a time every day, where I have to give my whole physical self to something, I think focuses in my mind in a way that few other things do. But everyone's different. And it's not a practice for everyone. Not everyone thinks that way, and more power to them. Right. But you know, I will say this. What upsets me are people who say, you know, well, this type of yoga is not real yoga, or, and my type of yoga is the only real yoga. The fact of the matter is yoga is a giant tradition from India that developed over thousands of years with lots of differing practices, not surprisingly. And so, you know, I think, I only get upset when people start claiming that their yoga is the one true yoga.
It sounds good to me. I appreciate, at the end of the day, and I've visited other studios, and I like learning about some of the more ancient kinds of chants. Mm-hmm. For example, there's certain kinds of breathing exercises that seem right. a little more embedded in the Indian and Hindu tradition, perhaps. I don't want to overstate, because I really am not well schooled in that. I appreciate that. I believe what I hear you saying is you can very much have this stilling of the mind mm-hmm. within a more athletic context. It's right. absolutely still available.
Right.
And every class I've had with you, by the end, we're very much landing we're relaxing into this plane of calmness, of clarity, and it's very much the goal of every Hot Yoga Plus class I've ever been to. You know, I'm not even sure what I would be looking for otherwise. So I'm a happy camper, and I will look to be a peacemaker and bridge builder. As
Excellent.
I go forward.
Well, I think that's right. And I also think that it's important to try different styles of yoga. If for no other reason, I think it, even if you don't love the style of yoga, the new style of yoga that you've tried, I think it makes you appreciate what you do even more. And I really make a point to try different things, to occasionally push myself out of my comfort zone, to take an Iyengar class where we sit in a pose for 5 minutes with props, which sort of makes me want to go crazy at the beginning, but it's a good discipline for me. And I always feel like I get something out of it. But then it also makes me appreciate the very active practice that I normally have.
Over the 9+ years you've been practicing, is there one area that you know has changed? You could answer that in a couple different ways. Ways of thinking about yoga, ways of experiencing yoga.
So, you know, I think one of the things that's really changed within the yoga community, you know, that's been hard in the short run, but I think is good in the long run. I think in the last decade, we've had the rise and very terrible fall of several big yoga leaders within yoga communities. John Friend of Anusara, of course, Bikram of the Hot 26 practice. There's lots of examples of this. And, you know, I think the difficult thing in yoga and really in life is that if you find some practice that really speaks to you, of course you get really into it. And what's happened in these communities is that there have been all these people who find these great practices, and they really connect with them, and then they begin to idolize the leader. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that, you know, John Friend came up with an amazing style of doing yoga. Bikram came up with a brilliant series, but they're human. and unfortunately, you know, have had both pretty steep falls, pretty terrible falls from grace. And so I think I mean, yes, it's been very hard for those communities. It was hard for the Anusara community. It's hard right now for the Bikram community. But at the same time, I think it's all helped us learn that it's never a good idea to idolize people. That's not a... I don't think that's yoga, and I don't think it's a good practice in life. Mm-hmm. So I think in the decade that I've been in yoga, I've really seen that change among yoga teachers.
I understand that. A desire to get away from personality cults.
Yes.
And to celebrate that every instructor is going to have strengths and weaknesses and abilities.
I think that's right.
I can imagine that. And that... I'm sure we both know Susanna, who leads High Yoga Plus, and she's, to my mind, someone that's a great example of a leader who wants to push the personality back out amongst everyone. It's not about an iconic...
I think that's right. And, you know, Susanna has met Bikram several times. Ooh, cool. And I think had a very like adverse reaction to just that. And I think that's part of why Susanna leads in the way that she does is she realizes that's not really a good practice over time.
You are now leading workshops around the city. You led a workshop recently at Tennessee Brew Works.
Yes.
Can you just talk about what's going on?
Well, you know, I lead workshops when I have a chance. The one at Tennessee Brew Works was actually just a class. My great friend Laura Burns is the brewer there. And so she's a yogi. And so she's really trying to get a yoga series started on the brewery floor, which is really fun. And then you get, of course, beer afterwards, which makes it even more fun. And so, you know, I think that being a good teacher is about, number one, continuing to take classes and continuing to take different types of classes and broadening your horizons. But I also think, you know, being a good teacher is just teaching a lot. I mean, what's the point of collecting all this knowledge if you can't share it with other people? And so, you know, I end up, whether it's through a formal workshop space or outside of class or within class, you know, I give lots of advice on inversions. I love arm balances, as you well know. Yes. But, you know, as I said at the beginning, I started out not very strong. And so it's definitely been, something that I've worked a lot on, and I feel like I have a lot of advice to give and a lot of help to give, and I'm more than happy to give it. And, you know, it may not work for everyone, because of course nothing does. But I think it can be helpful, for a lot of people. And I really enjoy, sharing the sort of tips and tricks of the trade, if you will, with anyone who's interested.
I really have benefited from the care that you are giving throughout class. When folks want to try an inversion, when folks want to try a more difficult pose, a particular kind of balance, a lot of times I'm so whooped by the time we get to that portion of class. I'm in a child's pose, which, as most folks know who do yoga, that's sort of the giant caution flag for I should probably be left alone. But I appreciate the safety that you provide, because you're so willing to help hold someone as they're getting into an inversion or be a kind of buffer if they're, you know, potentially going to try something they're not sure about.
So much of this is trust.
Yeah.
And, you know, something happens when we grow up that we lose all of our trust. And so that's why I always encourage people who are working on inversions to work against the wall, and then slowly back themselves away from the wall, because you've got to have something when you start doing inversions, to build up the trust that you lost, that we all have when we're kids, and then somehow just disappears.
That's wonderful. I totally agree with you on that. on your yoga mat, you're being pushed to try ways of trusting your body. For me, something like half moon. I'm standing on one leg, holding out the other at hopefully a 90-degree angle, although I don't always get that. And then my arms are like a T. And for me, I'm still learning how to do this better. But for me, just looking up at the ceiling instead of the ground during a half moon,
it's huge.
Took me a couple years. And it's a pretty slight. And for me, you know, is a giant pun with using your head or not using your head, and as you look up to the ceiling from the floor. But there's something about not worrying about falling. And there's, for me, when I make that minor twist of just looking from the floor to the ceiling in that pose, there is a kind of trust that I recover, and that. And I can't, and not, I mean, this is what you guys always say, this, every practice is different. Your body is always different.
That's right.
Some days I can really, you know, crush that. That was the wrong phraseology. But some days I can really do that. It's really a sense of, I'm learning to trust. I'm growing.
That's right.
One of the things I'm gleaning from your story is it's in part due to your yogic journey it's provided space in your life to be successful in other areas of your life.
I think that's right. I tell everyone that I think I would not be able to do my full-time job as well as I do if I didn't teach yoga. Mm-hmm. I also think the converse is true. I don't know that I would be as good of a yoga teacher if that was all I did.
Mm-hmm.
I sort of like the balance. It's not really left brain, right brain, but it's two totally different things. My day job is very cerebral, mm-hmm. I guess, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then countering that with something that's very physical, I think just provides the balance in my life that I need.
Hot Yoga Plus has studios in Nashville, which is where you and I met, Cool Springs, Chattanooga, what other?
Memphis!
Do you know anything about Memphis, Tennessee?
I do know a little bit about Memphis, Tennessee, because I spent the first almost 18 years of my life there, so.
You were born there.
I was born there. I was born and raised in the same house, lived there until I was almost 18.
No kidding.
Wow.
And just to make the connection, have you ever visited the Hot Yoga Plus Memphis studio?
So if I am there, for a friend's wedding or Christmas, I usually teach a class at Hot Yoga Memphis.
These sort of connections for me is what it's all about.
Yeah.
Born and raised in Memphis, and your mother and father are there today.
My father passed away 11 years ago, but my mom is still there, and my mom is actually a judge there.
Nice.
My mom was an attorney growing up, and then she got appointed as a probate judge there in 2013, and then ran, I guess, last summer and won, and so she'll be a judge there for the next 7 years, so...
That's wonderful.
Yeah, it's really, my mom is really amazing. It's funny because so many of my friends' parents are retiring, and my mom just started a second career. So, I mean, she's certainly a role model, for sure.
No, I'm not super informed on these things. Would she have practice law privately then before?
Okay. So she, her practice before was private practice. Yeah. She was in a small firm and she did mostly probate law. So probate is like wills, estates, conservatorships, yeah. Families fighting over parents' money, You know, all sorts of lovely things. So that was her, that was primarily her practice before. And then, but she had always been interested in being a judge, and one of the probate judgeships opened up in 2013, and the rest is history. So.
I think that's wonderful. So what I'm picking up on then is legal profession and experiences with law as a profession. This is something that's a narrative from early on.
Yeah, so the interesting thing is that I was always really interested in math and science growing up, and I never really thought I would go to law school. And then I went to college, and I realized my first year that that maybe I was really interested in practicing law. But then I also, you know, in the general confused state that college is, I decided that maybe I was really interested in law. But then particularly during my senior year of college, when I was writing my senior thesis, I thought, well, but I actually really like academic research too. Which I guess led to my career now. I grew up in my mom's law office. My mom would made a point to, if at all humanly possible, pick me up at school at 3 o'clock every day. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that meant that we had to go back to mom's office for an hour or two after she picked me up. So I definitely grew up around it. I guess in some sense, learn to think like a lawyer a little bit earlier than others. So I guess I did have that leg up.
Are you going to public school, private school? What kind of schooling?
So I went to a very tiny Catholic co-ed elementary school until sixth grade. And then I switched over in seventh grade when that school ended to an all-girls Catholic school. And that's where I went until I graduated.
As a young person, you said you're into math and science, so maybe there's some math and science kind of activities or clubs that are happening. Like, what was fun when you were young?
What did I do for fun? So I was always very into performing. So I danced, I sang, I did some theater. That was sort of the counter to all of the, you know, AP, math, calculus, chemistry things that I was doing in school otherwise. But I also, my parents were very clear from the beginning that academics came first. And, my dad always used to look at my report card and say, well, you got an A in this. Why isn't this an A+? So I definitely grew up with parents who had high expectations, and wanted me to do a lot of extracurricular activities, which I did, which I think kept me sane. Mm-hmm. And I think even today, extracurricular activities, keep me sane. But academics, always were number one, and as soon as something seemed like it was going to interfere, academics was number one.
Was your father was he in law? Was he in a different profession?
No, so he actually owned a mechanical repair company, and I have a half brother, and he still owns that, or he runs the company now in Memphis. Yeah, and so his job was very math and science-y. So he's sort of who I, if I needed help with math homework, he was always the parent to go to. My mom used to brag about the fact that she took extra science classes in college so she didn't have to take another math class ever again. So probably from the third grade on, my mom stopped helping me with math homework. But she was better at editing my paper, so.
That's good. So by the time you're getting up in high school, you're completing a lot of different kinds of activities. And you've identified that you're the kind of person that likes to take on a lot mm-hmm. and see how much you can get done.
Yes.
And you are looking at potential collegiate choices. And I know where you ended up going to college. I'm just, could you walk us through, or me and the folks that will be listening, could you just tell me a little bit about how you ended up, and please tell us where you did end up going to college?
So, I will admit that I did not appreciate Memphis the way that I should have when I grew up. So my goal was really to get as far away as possible. And maybe that's partially because I had lived in the same house my entire life. But I really wanted to go to the Northeast. I really wanted to go to big city. If you had told me when I was a senior in high school that I would end up back up in Tennessee, I would have said you were crazy. I did focus most of my college applications, in the Northeast. I had worked really hard in high school, and I wanted to go to the best school that I could. Mm-hmm. And so, I applied to pretty much all of the Ivy League schools, MIT. I went ahead and sent in an application to Vanderbilt as well. You know,
one of those.
Yeah. And so I actually, I got in, early to Harvard. And so I found out, I mean, I still remember, it was the middle of December, right in the middle of, finals. And, I got an email from Harvard saying that I'd been accepted. And, you know, I guess my year, there were only 7 kids from the city of Memphis who got accepted. And so, it's a really big deal in Memphis to get accepted to Harvard. The punchline is that I ended up going. but I will say that having gone to Harvard, you know, there's a lot of schools in the Northeast where half your class goes to Harvard. And I mean, of course, I would hope that it's somewhat of a big deal to everyone to get into Harvard, but it's a really big deal in Memphis. But you know, the funny thing is that, of course I was thrilled, to get into Harvard. And I knew I wanted to go to an Ivy League school, but I wasn't, entirely sure that Harvard was the place that I wanted to go. So I waited to get my April decision letters, went and revisited places, and realized that, you know, the kind of opportunities, that going to Harvard presents to you are just really hard to turn down. And so I went.
So I'm familiar with Vanderbilt. So I work with Vanderbilt's development and fundraising, and that overlaps just a tiny bit with being in meetings about admissions.
Yeah,
I know that Vanderbilt's I think the word is yield, how many students they can actually admit for undergrad. It's impossibly low compared to how many
That's
apply.
Right.
And Harvard is like 200 plus years older than Vanderbilt. I can only imagine. So it's even for me to hear that there may be 7 in one in Memphis that are offered admission is to me like, wow, I'm surprised it's even that many. And so
that's true.
And so I visited Harvard's campus a couple years ago. And
hopefully when the weather was good.
Yeah, it was good. It was actually, you noticed I was there on Facebook and you kindly recommended a few coffee
shops
right. to look at. And I went on Harvard's campus. I mean, for me, so I grew up in Portsmouth, Chesapeake, and Virginia Beach, Virginia, right at the bottom of the Virginia state on the coast. And from when I was the tiniest kid, and so few of my family members were able, for a variety of reasons, it's not a big higher education family that I grew up in, but I remember hearing about Harvard as a very young boy. It's like one of those things where you just know from my tiniest memories of what college even was, like, oh, and then there's Harvard where some people go. So as I got older and my life would end up intersecting with higher ed, I so appreciate what Harvard represents as sort of the ivory tower on top of the ivory tower. It is... it's the best and brightest. It's the truly compelling and curious, truly curious minds often and mostly end up at Harvard. And I don't know, what do you, going there, I mean, was it like going to, like, I can't even just, I mean, for me, I'm like, you're going where the guy that starts Facebook and draw, I mean, it's like.
Mark Zuckerberg was actually in my class, believe it or not.
So you can prove my points better than I can.
Yeah, so, you know, as a almost 18-year-old when I showed up on Harvard campus, I have to say I was more concerned at the time about socially fitting in and not knowing anyone. So there was only, of the seven who got in from Memphis, only two of us ended up going. And I sort of knew the other girl who was going. But you know, I didn't know anyone. And all of my other friends were going to Vanderbilt or Alabama or Ole Miss, and they were all rooming with each other. Mm-hmm. And college was going to be this great extension of high school social relationships. And so to move to a new place that was in some sense halfway across the country, knowing no one, it was scary. And you know, then the other, terrible things that preoccupy you when you're 17 is that Harvard also starts a month later, than Southern schools. And so I'd also been sitting at home for a month while my friends are having great fun at other colleges, thinking, like, getting increasingly nervous. But, you know, I found my niche, I think, my social niche pretty quickly there. But, you know, it's a, it is a place like no other. And you do have opportunities to work with, to learn from truly some of the greatest minds in the world and truly some of the best scholars in the world. But that being said, it's a hard place. Mm-hmm. It's not for everyone. It's not for everyone, even if you're brilliant. It's a hard place, particularly for people their freshman year, because almost everyone who goes there was the best and the brightest in their class. Had something in their recommendation letter that said they were the student of a generation. And then you're suddenly in a pool of 1,600 other students of a generation. And it can be overwhelming. It can also be difficult to deal with the fact that some of your fellow classmates are a little bit on the overzealous side. And that's socially difficult to deal with as well. I made my very best friends in the world in college. But I'll be the first to say that I have some pretty dark memories of studying for finals and not sleeping very much. Unfortunately, they've changed this now, thankfully, but winter finals used to be after Christmas. So we would go home for Christmas, and then on January 2nd, you come back for reading period, where you'd have to do a bunch of papers, and then you'd have finals. And January in Boston, if you've ever been to January in Boston, I hope you've never been to Boston in January. But it is just miserable. And so I do have some memories of just being very overwhelmed and maybe even depressed a little bit, just because I was so overwhelmed with work. But then there were really amazing sides to it too. To meet other overachievers like you, that have lots of interest. I think you have also the opportunity to make friends and connections there, that I don't know that I could have made at any other school.
Do you go back perhaps for like reunion kind of weekends or?
Yeah. So I, So I've gone back a couple of times. I was in an a cappella group in college, so been back a couple of times for a cappella concerts. Yes, I went back for my fifth year, and I will go back next spring for my 10th year. which is amazing because, you know, of course, like after college, you know, you only keep in touch with a small group of your closest friends. And so it's really neat to go back and see people you haven't even thought about, in several years. And I think it's particularly cool at Harvard because people are doing really interesting, amazing things that change the world. And so to see that, is really unmatched.
There has to be a wonderful network of Harvard alumni that you enjoy some access to. Not that you're reaching out. I mean, you're a busy person. Not that you're, like, you know, trying to make friends around the world. But just the knowledge of the alumni are particularly placed as leaders around corporate world and governmental occasions. And then Harvard's a global institution, and has that been something you've looked at or occasionally tapped into, this idea of there's a network that's kind of at my back if I need them?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a couple of different ways. I don't have this sort of overtly networking personality, I guess is the best way to describe it. I've never liked the idea of calling in favors or, which, you know, if you can do it and work it, I think that's great, but that's just not my personality. But I think for me, it's worked in a couple of different ways. Certainly, friends and acquaintances, that I've had, that I had from college, if something came up and I was going to be in the area, or if I was, you know, trying to reach out to someone and couldn't get in touch with them, you know, if it's a big company, you know, I might know someone in that company from Harvard, and somebody who has access to the person I'm trying to get in touch with. So I think it works in that way for me. I will also say that, being an academic now, I think that it opens doors. People see Harvard on your resume and they give you the benefit of the doubt, maybe they shouldn't. But I'll take it if they will give it to me.
You're finishing up at Harvard as a senior, and you were looking at opportunities. The next step could have probably taken a variety of different forms. And how did Memphis perhaps look different at the end of your Harvard chapter? Did you have a different relationship with the Memphis you left?
Oh, absolutely. I think from my freshman year, I immediately began appreciating Memphis more. Moving to the Northeast, and particularly moving to Boston, native Bostonians will give you the shirt off their back, but they may make a rude comment in the process. It is a very blunt, sometimes rude, at least rude by Southern standards, culture. In a way that I was not prepared for. It sounds so silly to go on and on about the weather, but honestly, Boston is pretty miserable 7 to 8 months out of the year, and sometimes nine. And it is beautiful 3 months out of the year. We always joke that on admitted students weekend that the president of Harvard, like, has a connection in with the weather gods, because it's always, of course, beautiful on admitted students weekend. Harvard's graduation used to be in June, and it would often be like 40 and raining in June, which is just, you know, as a native Southerner, it's not right. And I think it's also, I mean, it's in the realm of, you know, it's easy to get depressed when it's snowy and cold and you don't want to go outside and it's gray. That was hard in a way that I never imagined because, of course, being a Southerner and snow was an exciting event. I was, of course, delighted to go to a place where it snowed 6 months out of the year until I actually lived there. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think between the weather and the culture, and maybe even the food, not Boston has amazing food and Boston has some amazing ethnic food, but the sort of, now, I'm not into the real fatty, like, down-home cooking sort of thing. But just, like, I don't know, Southern food, barbecue, is suddenly a lot more appealing. Oh, that's another thing that I learned in the Northeast is that barbecue in the Northeast does not mean barbecue, like, Southern pulled pork barbecue. It's, like, it is what they use for, like, oh, we're going to grill some hamburgers. Let's have a barbecue.
Not the same.
Not the same.
Not the same.
So, yeah, I mean, I realized pretty quickly that, hey, the South's not so bad, and Memphis is pretty great, and Tennessee is pretty great. But, you know, you have to go away to learn these mm-hmm. things.
Memphis is connected, for me, to some of the great... And this is a little bit of a cliche, but if there is, for me, an idea of kind of the struggling soul of America, mm-hmm. even in present day, maybe for me particularly in present day, when I look at Memphis and in the relatively small education that I have from visiting that city a handful of times, but I know about, and maybe a lot of folks think about the arts in Memphis, there's... You know, low-hanging fruit, there's Elvis. but then, you know, there's other... And I know there's entire museums of Memphis musicians, including, like, Johnny Cash apparently moved there to start his career. There's the Sun Records Studio. There's all the folks that can... There's Al Green.
B.B. King.
B.B. King.
Yep.
B.B. King, absolutely. It's... And for me, when I look at those artists, they are primarily pulled themselves up by their bootstraps, mm-hmm. came from very humble beginnings, and end up becoming a kind of mouthpiece for the common man, and in some cases for the African American. By the time you get, as I'm sure you know better than I, just by the time you get to, like, the civil rights movement, Memphis is an amazing space. There's stuff happening with Dr. King by literally the end of his life, where he's assassinated there in Memphis.
Right.
Did those things were they embedded in your head in some way when you, as a young woman, and then you saw, I'm just curious, and you saw them maybe differently by the time you go through Harvard? Could you just talk about that at all?
Yeah. So you're exactly right. I think particularly picking up on the racial issue, the racial divide in Memphis, the large number of African American poor, working poor, in the city continues to divide the city in a way that's really sad. And that Memphis can't seem to escape, and it's always something that people are talking about, and it's always something that's on people's mind. And I think that most Memphians want it not to be an issue anymore, but can't seem to agree on the best way to get past it. I think that that's exactly right. As I grew up, I was very much a part of this conversation without really realizing it. Now I work on employment discrimination. I think it's why I've always been interested in labor market discrimination, because I grew up in a place where discrimination was always present, always something that people were talking about, always something that leaders were thinking about, how do we make this better? And so I think that that's absolutely how I got interested in what I do for my full-time job. But moving to the Northeast was also interesting to me in the sense that I always felt like in Memphis, and you know, I'm sure part of it was the crowd I hung out in. I had a lot of African American friends, and I felt like at one of the things that always struck me at Harvard is that. And part of it is because there are so few African Americans at Harvard, but they felt a little more segregated to me in a way that they're not in Memphis, which is really counterintuitive, right? Mm-hmm. But it was something that I immediately picked up on and I immediately noticed, and so it's funny because like I think on the outside. You know, Memphis, people worry that Memphis is doing everything wrong, because we still have racial issues. But at the same time, I think a lot of what Memphis is doing is right because it's because people are having a conversation, about, how do we make this issue better? And I'm not sure that other places are having that kind of conversation.
That's fascinating to me that you, if I understand you right, you're saying at Harvard, the handful of African American friends you had there felt segregated, or you picked up on an element of that?
Yeah. So, I mean, so I'll give you this example. So all the freshmen, at Harvard eat in the same dining hall. And so a lot of, a good majority of the African American students would eat at their own table. I that certainly wasn't true for all of them. It certainly was their choice. But that was so odd to me. And I felt like I had fewer African American friends in college than I did in high school, which I never would have expected. But was absolutely the case. And that's what led me to this belief of, at least in Memphis, the really progressive people are having a conversation about this, maybe Memphis is doing something right.
Yeah. I love that. I love that you're able to connect, and I do want to talk about your professional experience last few years. But I'm fascinated that Harvard wasn't necessarily this idyllic post-race society.
Well, you know, Harvard has a very interesting history of discrimination. I don't think that they let in Jewish students until shockingly late. Which is crazy. I guess in retrospect, in some sense, it's not. I mean, look, there's no overt discrimination going on at Harvard at all. I don't mean to imply that at all, but it is not. It is not a idyllic post-race world where everyone is colorblind. Because another thing that I think isolates some African American students at Harvard is that. In the world of race being considered in admissions, I think a lot of African American students feel like they have to justify their place there. That I didn't just get in because I got a bump because of my race, which is terrible. Mm-hmm. But I definitely. I remember being in a philosophy class my senior year of college, and we were talking about considering race and admissions, and one of the girls in my discussion section, who was a junior, said, you know, I feel like I have to prove myself every day and prove that I deserve to be here. And, you know, I certainly felt that way my freshman year, but by my junior year, that had faded. And so I think it's just also, I think in some sense it's a self-consciousness that drives it as well.
You, just to back up, you are going to, as a high school student, you went to a girls-only female high school, that was Catholic as well?
Yes.
And are you able in that environment to have a variety of friends on the racial spectrum, or was it more like maybe other ways of interacting?
Yeah, so, I mean, I will be honest. There was one African-American girl in my graduating class. Yeah. So, I can't say my high school did the best job of being integrated, but I was, I guess because I did a lot of theater, I had friends from all backgrounds, both racially, socioeconomically, and so maybe I'm different. There's just a lot of opportunities in Memphis. I think through extracurricular activities when you're a kid, to really get out and meet people from literally all different backgrounds, from the city.
I mean, you've made this connection a little bit already, and I think we're making it more just how your early life would eventually play into your current role. And just to review, you are an assistant professor of law at Vanderbilt University Law School.
That's right.
And you began as faculty, as assistant professor, would that have been last fall?
Yes.
Okay. And so you've completed the first year.
Yes.
It's all downhill from there.
I hope so. Until tenure.
Right. There's the tenure conversation, which, you know, that's another mountaintop. But you did a combination degree, and correct me if I get this wrong, but it's a combination degree of getting your JD and also your JD in law, of course, and then your PhD in economics.
That's right.
It's a dual degree. How many years program is that?
It's 6 years.
6 years.
After college.
Yes. Now, I know your husband's at the postdoc level. How many years has he trained to be?
So he did 4 years of medical school, and then he's done 7 years of general surgery. He's on his seventh year of general surgery residency, but after this year, it's done.
The mighty Chenals are in it to win it long term, and I love that about you guys. But you are teaching, it's like... employment labor practice sort of?
Yes. So I have, in some sense, a joint appointment within the law school as both a traditional law faculty member, but also a faculty member in the law and economics program. Mm-hmm. So the law and economics program is the joint degree program that I graduated from, but the classes that we offer are meant to train PhD economists. So like coming up this fall, I will teach employment law to JD students, which the goal of that is to teach them about what types of employment cases are actionable, how to bring an employment case, how to bring cases for things like medical leave, et cetera. And then I will also teach Labor Economics 1, which will be the first semester of the graduate level economics sequence in labor. So I'll have a very think and talk about cases class, and then I'll have a very mathy class. But that's sort of me. I think I've ended up where I needed to be because I've always been a very, I've never been happy just doing sort of right brain things or just left brain things. I need to do both. I can't do math all day. I can't just write all day. I got to do both.
Your research interests, and this is me just looking up a few things on the Vanderbilt website, as the site has it listed, it's some of what you already said, employment law, labor economics, and legal economic history. also you're doing some research at maybe an intersection between the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the American Disability Amendment, American Disabilities Act Amendment of 2008. The reason I'm saying all this, I know some of this research led to a well-received study that went, I know it went national, and I know you were picked up by national news. Even, I mean, at the popular level, it's rare to me to see academic research reaching both that academic, the institutional crowd, and then also the populace. Can you talk, it was obesity in the workplace as it relates to women being discriminated against?
That's right.
I said it in a weird way, but... Can you just talk a little bit about what that was?
Yeah. So basically, the crux, the focus of my research is all about weight in the labor market. So economists have known for about a decade or two from looking at labor market data that individuals who are obese, which is, means you have a body mass index of 30 or more, which body mass index is just a weight to height ratio. Individuals who are obese, they're less likely to be employed. And even if they are employed, they earn less than non-obese individuals. So the big question has been why. And so, you know, of course, medical health studies suggest that obesity could affect your productivity to the extent that obesity affects your musculoskeletal system to the extent that it impedes your ability to walk or do physical tasks. Maybe you're a less productive worker. Maybe it means you miss work more. So that's one hypothesis, is that it works through the mechanism of reduced productivity. The other hypothesis is that it's discrimination. People don't like obese people. People don't want them to be the face of their company. Something that looks more like what economists call taste-based discrimination. Something that looks more like what we think of when we think about the South in the 1950s. This sort of overt, I don't like working with this group of people, discrimination. And so economists have been trying to find clever ways of testing these hypotheses, because unfortunately for us, you know, there are very few labor market data sets that also have your height and weight information. And even of those that do, it's very hard to get like a direct productivity measure. And it's impossible to get any sort of, you know, employer attitudes measure. Mm-hmm. So we have to sort of think of more creative ways of getting around the data constraints. So what I did is that I focused on occupational characteristics of different types of jobs. So I have a labor market data set that has a random sample of individuals across the country. I have their wage information. I have what sort of occupation they do. And then I also have information on their educational background, some demographic information. And so my idea was this. So if the productivity hypothesis is right, then we would expect it to be most true in jobs that emphasize physical activity. So jobs where you have to lift or walk or have stamina, et cetera, et cetera. And so if the productivity hypothesis is right, we expect to see fewer obese people working in these physical activity jobs. And those who were working in these physical activity jobs would earn less because they weren't as productive. On the other hand, if the sort of taste-based explanation is correct, then we would expect that issue to be most salient in what I call public interaction jobs. So jobs where you have to be the face of the company, jobs where you have to deal with customers and clients a lot. And so I matched a bunch of data sets together and matched labor market data information to something called the Occupational Information Network, where there's a lot of ratings, unbiased ratings of how important different elements or different occupational characteristics are to each kind of job in the economy. And so what I found was this, is that obese individuals are, if anything, more likely to work in physical activity jobs. But this is particularly true for women. So we see this really clear pattern in the data for women. So once a woman becomes overweight, she is more likely than a normal weight woman to work in a physical activity job. She becomes obese, she becomes increasingly more likely. And morbidly obese women who are BMI of 40 or more. So just to put that in perspective, if you're 5'4", you would be about 240 pounds. You are the most likely to work in a physical activity job, which is very counterintuitive, right? And it certainly seems to negate this productivity hypothesis. On the other hand, for these public interaction jobs, not really anything in the data for men, but we see the converse pattern for women. So once a woman becomes overweight, she's less likely to work in a public interaction job. As she becomes obese, she's even less likely. And as she becomes morbidly obese, she's pretty unlikely to work in a public interaction job. And then the punchline is for morbidly obese women is that even if they get a public interaction job, they're paid less than normal weight women for doing exactly the same job. So this, of course, really suggests this taste-based discrimination explanation, but it also suggests a sex discrimination element to this issue. Because everything that seems to be happening with obesity in the labor market really centers around women, it really seems to be more of a sex discrimination issue. I call it the newest form of sex discrimination against women, more than it is, a disability or a productivity issue or something else.
It's fascinating. The main takeaway that I continue to get is it's what you said with obese women being in the very jobs that we have all sort of construed, well, they wouldn't be there. But they are.
Right. And so my best explanation for what's going on as to why obese women are in these physical activity jobs. So physical activity jobs tend to be blue collar jobs. They tend to be low paying jobs. They tend to be jobs that maybe would be everyone else's last choice. So if you look in the data and see what sort of jobs morbidly obese women are working in, they're working in home health care aides, daycare workers, nurses aides, jobs where you're making minimum wage. It's hard labor. And so I believe what's going on is that these are the only jobs that these women can get.
Mm. Help me out a little bit as a layperson, not as familiar as I could be or just am with how legal information affects change. Does this research, does it then slowly get, or maybe quickly get, into the hands of labor-related law firms, and then they begin to take cases for clients? Could you walk me through what maybe a good or best-case scenario would be of some change?
Yeah, so So that's, of course, the great challenge as an academic is getting people to read your work. And, of course, if you get lucky and get some publicity, then it becomes easier. But it's still hard to make the connection because there is such a disconnect between legal academics and legal practitioners for the most part. So here's the way, I guess, I hope it's starting to work and it eventually should work. So since the 2008 amendments to the Americans with Disabilities Act, a lot of attorneys have been bringing weight discrimination cases under the Americans with Disabilities Act, claiming that obesity is a disability for the purposes of the act. So to the extent that you discriminate against someone on the basis of their weight, you're also discriminating against them on the basis of their disability. And so what I argue in my research is that the ADA is the wrong legal paradigm. So there's a very technical legal reason that I'll try to explain why I don't think it will work. So the ADA, the statute doesn't put out a list of disabilities that are covered by the act. So it doesn't say if you're in a wheelchair, you're disabled. Instead, it defines disability in this very specific way. It says you are disabled if you are substantially limited in a major life activity, or if your employer regards you as being substantially limited in a major life activity. So my data, of course, shows that obese individuals are actually working in these jobs where if they were ever going to be regarded as substantially limited, it would be in a physical activity jobs. And so I don't think that that's the right legal paradigm. I don't think it's going to work for them. I think it's going to be hard, particularly for an obese individual who's in a physical activity job, to prove to a court that they're substantially limited in a major life activity or regarded as substantially limited. What I'm suggesting that if an attorney is presented with a client who has a weight discrimination case, instead of bringing it under the ADA, if their client is a woman, what they really should be bringing it under is Title VII as a form of sex discrimination. Mm. And there is a bit of precedent to this. These cases have gone away for 20 years, but there actually have been successful weight-based cases under Title VII. If you ever flew in an airplane before, 1985, you will know that all the flight attendants were very young and fit and very thin and held to extreme weight standards. And the reason that, we have male flight attendants and that, flight attendants can be a normal weight now and don't have to go to weigh-ins is because attorneys brought successful Title VII cases in the 70s and the 80s. And then those cases just sort of disappeared. But what I'm suggesting is that they should come back based on some of these employer policies. So for me, the challenge is, and I'm getting out and talking to as many, groups and lawyers as I can. But for me, the challenge is getting to these labor lawyers and telling them, hey, this is a Title VII issue. It's not really an ADA issue for most obese workers. It's really more of a Title VII issue.
This is fantastic. I'm learning in real time about this whole it's a significant issue. Do you know, I guess, to bring it back a little bit to just the popular cultural, as I understand it, there's an obesity epidemic in the South, and particularly in Tennessee. I want to say I've heard stats and like maybe one in four, not just women, but maybe, do you know some of this kind of thing off the top of your head? Or
so a third of the country is obese, I believe.
Meaning their BMI is
30 or more. Yes.
And you said one third of...
Yes.
There's like 300-ish million Americans or something.
Yes.
So there's there's a lot.
So there's a lot of, there's obviously a lot of different aspects to the obesity research going on. We still, of course, don't have a very clear answer of what is driving the obesity epidemic. If you read the New York Times, they have a different article every week with some very opinionated person about they have the solution. Truth be told, I think it's a lot of different things happening at once. I think it's change in food supply, change in how much we move around and how active our jobs are. I mean, I think it's, I don't know that anyone is wrong, but I don't think that there's any one singular explanation for the obesity epidemic. So the really interesting thing, I think, that relates to my research is that there's no evidence that this obesity wage and employment penalty is decreasing over time. So even though in the last 10 or 20 years, there are an increasing number of obese individuals in the labor market, we haven't seen people say, oh, well, everyone's obese now, so it's not really a big deal that you're overweight. The level of weight discrimination is not going down, even though it's a lot more common to be obese. There's still a lot of blame going on. Which is bad, because I think that first that the blame is counterproductive, and And to the extent that we don't exactly know what's driving these large increases in obesity, it's not, we don't know the entire cause. So it seems not quite right to blame people for being obese.
It seemed, I guess I'm overwhelmed thinking about the ramifications of, I mean, clearly this is a health crisis of massive proportion, and we're seeing it being played out even further, though, in this, you mentioned, kind of this taste-based environment, and so I think you're drawing to my mind just the layers of difficulty and complexity that we have to be thinking about.
No, I think that's right. And I think, you know, my, I mean, I get a lot of very, puzzled looks, honestly, of, you know, but you're so committed to health and fitness, and how can you be an obesity advocate or an advocate for obese individuals? I don't think that those are incompatible, right? I think, you know, I am very much for everyone being the healthiest person that they can be. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I don't think that everyone is going to be a size 2 either. I mean, that's just not everyone's body.
Right.
And it's not everyone's reality given their economic circumstances, given their social circumstances, et cetera. So I don't think that they're incompatible. And I think I think that one of the things that really, I think, you know, obviously one of the things that drew me to this research is just my interest in health and fitness. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, one of the things that's really resonated with me about my empirical results is that, you know, growing up as a dancer, I was very aware from a very young age on a pressure that's very particular to women to be thin. Obviously it's more extreme in the dance world than it is in the rest of the world. But it's something that I've been aware of from the very beginning. And I have to say, when I started this research, I did not have any priors, and I got these results and I thought, gosh, how do I make sense of that? And then I thought, actually it makes complete sense.
Did you have family members or friends that you knew they struggled with weight?
No, I mean, you know, I think if you ask any woman, they're always conscious of their weight. I mean, you know, my mom has never been overweight, but, you know, of course I heard her weighing herself, saw her weighing herself every day and thinking I need to lose weight. So I don't have any family members, or immediate family members at least, who are overweight or obese. But I will say my dad was a smoker and worked all the time and didn't take care of himself. And so, I think that part of what has drawn me to obesity research and just also being a healthy adult is, I guess doing the opposite of your parents, is to try to really take care of myself. Cause as we always say in yoga class, this is the one body you have. You don't get another one. And really, drawn me to this perspective of being the healthiest person you can be.
Mm-hmm. I do. I mean, you mentioned it a minute ago with there is a surprise in knowing you that is, you have a desire to represent this segment of society who, I'm going to take a wild guess, they aren't overly represented. there's not a lot of champions. I might be wrong. Just representing that you deserve great treatment as an employee.
There's some in California, but outside of California.
Well, the South.
Right, right.
And I find that to be a kind of fascinating component of your interest and how you ended up there. And that the story is ongoing. And this research you've completed, and it's gotten a lot of great attention. I'm sure you're still fielding emails, phone calls, and so forth. I'll be curious to see where it goes.
Yeah, I'm still continuing obesity-based research. I'm thinking a lot now. We just got a grant to do some empirical work to look at what types of incentives employers can use to get their employees healthier. You know, not necessarily lose weight, but mm-hmm. to get healthier. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, as you know, starting a nutrition routine, starting a fitness routine is tough. Mm-hmm. Sticking to it is even tougher. and so, yeah, I mean, I'm going to continue down this road for hopefully quite a while.
Jen, I really appreciate the chance to talk to you about these many different aspects of, to my mind, a life that's really blossoming, and I appreciate the accessibility that you always show through the yoga classes. You're always one thing that surprised me a couple of classes ago was the next class was about to come in early in the morning. I mean, we did the earliest class, and the next class was coming in, and you had put us through one of your classic sort of like come to the Lord experiences, and most of us were still laid out in sweet Shavasana, and a few other yogis were coming in, and they didn't necessarily even have a place to sit yet, and the few spaces that were available had pools of sweat from the earlier class that you had just finished, and so there you are, wiping with like sanitizer spray and a rag. You're cleaning off areas for the next class of yogis to come. And I don't think you were teaching that class. I think Adam was teaching that class. But I appreciate your willingness to keep it real with all of us who are doing the best we can in yoga. and then keep it real with the, you know, not to overdo it, but kind of the wider world, your desire to be in touch with frail and not always respected parts of society. I think, particularly, to me, it's laudable. And I don't think, I mean, just to carry some of the body shaming thing out, I don't think that we're going to make any headway as a society by continuing to alienate each other on body issues. And instead, I think drawing out more dignity at large from all of us. We all deserve a little better. We deserve respect. We deserve to be able to get ahead in our jobs and not receive forms of demotion.
Right.
All these things are, for me, they're hopefully meta narratives that I'm compelled by and inspired by. So we covered a lot of territory. I hope that you have enjoyed this sort of torrential amount of conversation.
I have. It was great to be here.
Oh man, oh man, oh man, oh man, oh man. I would just invite anyone within the sound of this voice to come, if you can do it, come out for a class at Hot Yoga Plus. I believe they offer a complimentary first class. You'd want to call and confirm that ahead of time. But their website, hotyogaplus.com, I'm pretty sure. I'll put all of this at theattentionist.com show notes at the episode. But Jen is teaching class several times a week. It's typically early. Special thanks just in general to the Hot Yoga Plus community. My dear friend Susanna is the director and owner of the Hot Yoga Plus group of stores, and so many amazing instructors work with Hot Yoga Plus. And man, I I hesitate to list them because I have only had awesome ones. So the website's really cool. Makes it easy to make appointments through their online interface. So if you have any questions, LILWHQ@gmail.com. That is my email and would be pleased to interact with you. Thank you so much for listening. Again, my name is Jeff Little. This is The Attentionist.